You're listening to Non-Zero World. I'm your host, Connor Eccles. Each week, I break down the latest developments in U.S. foreign policy and other global news, and I interview a leading expert or activist. To gain access to full-length episodes and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at Robert Wright's Non-Zero newsletter at nonzero.org. Welcome to Non-Zero World. I'm your host, Connor Eccles. In a few minutes, I'll be joined by Non-Zero Editor-in-Chief Robert Wright to discuss all of the biggest foreign policy news of the week, but first, here are some of the headlines. Israeli soldiers fired warning shots near a group of diplomats in the West Bank, Israel's military said, explaining that the gunfire was meant to push the delegation back to its quote-unquote approved route. The disruption occurred as some in the delegation, which included officials from Europe, Asia, and the Middle East, participated in media interviews in the Jenin refugee camp. Israeli forces have conducted numerous deadly raids in Jenin in recent months. Kaja Kallas, the European Union's top foreign policy official, demanded that Israel hold the shooters accountable, adding that, quote,
"Any threats on diplomats' lives are unacceptable."
President Trump inaugurated the Golden Dome missile defense project, which would put American weapons in space for the first time, and appointed a four-star Air Force general to oversee it. China warned that the Golden Dome would, quote, "exacerbate the risk of turning outer space into a battlefield and starting an arms race," end quote, and Russia said the project underlines the need for renewed U.S.-Russia talks on nuclear weapons and other issues of strategic stability. The Golden Dome, named after Israel's Iron Dome system, would combine land-based and space-based military assets. Newspapers around the country published a summer book list consisting mainly of titles that were products of AI hallucination. The 15-book list, which ran in the print edition of the Chicago Sun-Times, the Philadelphia Inquirer, and several other newspapers, included 10 non-existent books, some attributed to such venerated authors as Isabel Allende and Percival Everett. The list was supplied by Hearst-owned King Features, which sells syndicated content like comic strips and puzzles. The Sun-Times apologized for what it called a learning moment. President Trump signed into law the Take It Down Act, which criminalizes the sharing of sexually explicit AI deepfakes and other non-consensual intimate images. The bill breezed through Congress despite concerns from civil liberties groups that some provisions, like requiring platforms to remove flagged content within 48 hours or face fines, could chill speech. Trump inflamed those concerns in March when he said in a seemingly joking tone that, quote,
"I'm going to use that bill for myself, too, if you don't mind. Because nobody gets treated worse than I do online. Nobody."
The world's tropical forests were destroyed at a record rate in 2024, releasing more greenhouse gases than are emitted annually by the European Union, according to a new study from researchers at the University of Maryland. Wildfires, once rare in the tropics, caused much of this destruction, bolstering the theory that climate change is leading to a feedback loop. In this scenario, warming temperatures create conditions for fires that are, quote, "much more ferocious than they've ever been," end quote, as an analyst at the World Resources Institute told the BBC. Vietnamese officials expedited the groundbreaking of a $1.5 billion Trump Organization golf resort so that Eric Trump could break ground on the project during his current visit to Hanoi, according to Reuters. The gesture comes as the Vietnamese government is lobbying President Trump to abandon his threat to subject Vietnam to a 46% tariff. As the president ponders that policy, his son Eric will explore plans to build a skyscraper in Ho Chi Minh City. Now let's go to my conversation with Robert Wright, in which we talk about everything from Israel to Ukraine and, of course, a little bit of AI news. I hope that you'll stick around. Hey, Bob, how you doing?
I'm doing good, Connor. How are you?
Pretty good. Thank you for joining on this fine edition of Non-Zero World, the weekend edition of the Non-Zero podcast, which is your podcast after all. So people will probably recognize you as a special guest.
I'm very special, Connor, as you know. It's so great to be here. Such a classy joint. I know you always like wear button down blue Oxford shirt, and so I'm I'm wearing a button-down white Oxford shirt. I thought, like, it would be a little too weird to go blue. But I hope I'm up to the, like, did I get past the velvet rope here?
Am I worthy? I think so. I think you've made it into the room. That is the challenge of Non-Zero World, is that there just has been a shortage of classiness on the rest of the podcast. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Right. So I thought that I'd spiff it up a little bit, and I'm glad that the message has gotten across.
Yeah. I mean, the reason this platform, we're recording on Zencastr now, it has like a waiting room, and that's so you can evaluate the people, right? Because most of them do not get in. Right. Yeah. Into the actual session. Yeah.
Yeah. No schlubs in Non-Zero World. We're a very serious podcast. Anyway, why don't I go ahead and get us moving a little bit? So the biggest news of the week, the various biggest news lines have kind of surrounded Israel in various different ways. You know, I mentioned in the headlines at the top of this show, the Israeli soldiers who in the West Bank shot towards some diplomats, creating a lot of furor. There was, of course, also the tragic news of two Israeli diplomats here in D.C. who were murdered, kind of gunned down, coming out of an event that has been described in various ways, but that was sponsored by a group whose mission, I think, is primarily, related to Judaism and advancing sort of Jewish issues. So it's been this really challenging sort of moment where you're seeing a lot of backlash against Israel's actions in Gaza, which have continued to escalate, and you're seeing it hitting sort of members of the Jewish community here in D.C. And I mean, it's stark. It's like I'm like a 20-minute walk from where that shooting happened, probably right mm-hmm. now where I'm recording. So it definitely has left quite a mark. And anyway, yeah, I'm kind of curious. Do you have any thoughts on that broad topic?
Yeah, well, it's sad. Obviously, and it is disturbing, because although, you know, this guy isn't representative of, you know, any kind of broad, he's not representative of the pro-Palestinian movement broadly, still, as dedicated and, passionate movements continue, there's bound to be some extremists in them. And so this is exactly the kind of thing you worry about. And I guess the one thing I would say that's probably not being said all that widely, is I would like to see a little more discussion, about the connection between the Gaza war and the likelihood of things like this happening. First of all, obviously, all criminal and moral blame for the murders falls on the murderer. He should go to jail for a long time. But I personally think whenever you have a tragedy like this, it makes sense to go back and ask whether there are things you can do in the future that will make things like this less likely to happen. So in other words, trace out the causality as thoroughly as you can. It kind of reminds me of the Ukraine war. After the invasion, I did something pretty unpopular, as some other people did, which is to talk about what we considered missteps in U.S. foreign policy that had made the invasion more likely. And I said, look, Putin invaded. He's the one who broke the law. But we should ask, was NATO expansion a mistake? Was this a mistake? And so on. I thought they were mistakes and that we could learn from that. But so it's very much an analogous situation. People are reluctant to attribute things like this to anything other than, the murder's malign motives, which is certainly fair in itself. In this case, anti-Semitism, that's kind of the standard thing to say.
Yeah.
But I think we should just look as broadly as possible for causes. And I think the fact is that there's a connection between the Gaza war, which I think Biden had the power to stop. Trump had the power to stop. In a way, more power than Bibi Netanyahu had in a certain sense, because in a way they were less politically constrained than him. But in any event, I think, we should talk about that more than it's being talked about. I think more people are thinking about it than are talking about it, precisely because you can get pilloried from people who say, you know, you're blaming somebody other than the killer or something. I'm sorry, this is the way I look at policy analysis generally.
Yeah. I mean, one thing I would add is that this principle, I think that you're laying out maybe is best used if you're applying it sort of across the board to a lot of these issues and other places that we've seen violence back here in the U.S. We saw a Palestinian student shot, I think it was in Vermont last year, and for seemingly related motives to being Palestinian. We had a Palestinian child who was shot and killed in Chicago in the early days of the war, seemingly related to all this. And all of it comes down to when there is tension abroad, when there is high levels of conflicts that rend the U.S. like this. I mean, you get these violent attacks that are terrible and that are nightmarish, right? And that are a direct result of these tensions that continue in countries that, even if they're far away, clearly have this very strong emotional impact here in the U.S.
Yeah. No, I mean, another kind of analogy is the terrorist incidents that thankfully became less common, the so-called homegrown radical Islamist terrorist incidents. I was inclined to point out that if you looked at what these people actually said about their motivations, it often had to do with the fact that the U.S. was bombing various Muslim countries, had intervened in various Muslim countries, and we should take that into account if we want to reduce the frequency of these things. That was similarly unpopular in some corners, but I do think that's the way you need to approach these things. And I really think in this case, it would be good for Israel, as well as the United States, as well as the Palestinians, actually. This is, I believe, a non-zero-sum problem. There are things that are bad for all and good for all. I think it would be better for all if we talked more about stuff like this, because I think Israel's current policy is not good for Israel. And I don't think it's good for America. And I think this shooting is an example. It's not the only example of, you know, how the social fabric of America is being tested to some extent as a result of the continuation of the war. But it's an example of that. And you know, as for Israel itself, there was a piece in The Economist, maybe by Greg Carlstrom, or maybe it was just an unsigned lead, about kind of, it was something like Israel, what was it? Israel Unchained or something. The point was, right, Israel was just like going after everybody, kind of. I mean, they're bombing Syria. They feel no constraints because the opposition has been so degraded. And I personally don't think that is good long-term policy. You know, I've had Ron Campius on a few times, veteran correspondent for the now retired for the Jewish News Service, JTA. And we've talked about this, and he agreed with me that the Israeli mindset is kind of like, look, they're going to hate us no matter what we do. We have to be as tough as possible. We're in a tough neighborhood, and so we're going to do it, and we're not going to care. And yeah. I just think that's a tragic mistake to think they're going to hate you no matter what they do. I mean, just look at the polls over the last few years. You may be an unfairly hated nation, but the amount of hatred can go up and down, and it's gone up. And, you know, it was common in news reports here's actually, I have the lead of a New York Times piece, which overall is not a bad piece, but the breaking story in the New York Times was, the lead is, the slaying of two Israeli embassy aides on Wednesday outside a Jewish museum in Washington was an extreme example of what law enforcement officials and others call a global surge in anti-Semitic incidents that emerged after Hamas terrorists killed more than 1,200 people and seized 250 hostages on October 7th. It did emerge after that, but I do think if you do the thought experiment where suppose Israel had responded with much more restraint, and I'm not saying that given political and geopolitical constraints, this was even possible, but as a thought experiment, if Israel had done the minimum necessary to preserve its security in the wake of this, I think you would have seen the polls move in the other direction. There was a tremendous amount of sympathy, as I recall, immediately after the attack. Anyway.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting to see the ways in which, and there's just been so much, you know, the timing of this attack. I mean, you can't really attach it to any one thing, but obviously there's been a great increase of intensity in what's going on in Gaza. You pointed to the fact, and we included a lot of this in this week's Earthling. There's all of these different sort of governments that have become increasingly frustrated with Israel. There's been all these different people. There was a poll this week showing that among 18 to 24 year olds in the U.S., this is a poll from Harvard and Harris, I believe, and it found that like 45%, if you ask them not, do you support like Israel or the Palestinians? If you ask them, do you support Israel or Hamas? 55% said Israel, 45% said Hamas. That is remarkable, right? Mm-hmm. That is an extraordinary shift that I think should not be underestimated in the ways that the Israeli government is evaluating its policies, because it does need to take into account the way that it's viewed abroad. And you do get the sense that they have sort of stopped at all really focusing on that. To the extent that they ever did, Israeli leaders have obviously, you know, they recognize the scourge of anti-Semitism. They recognize that historically people have been anti-Jewish for reasons that have nothing to do with anything a Jewish person has ever done, right? But then they end up, there ends up being this conflation between Zionism and Jewishness that can be really damaging, I think, for the international Jewish community. And you hear it a lot from Jewish people in the West.
You hear the conflation, or you hear the...
No, you hear the concern. I mean, from especially younger, kind of more progressive Jewish people in the U.S., you hear a lot of concern that these policies are putting them in greater danger than they otherwise would be.
Well, that's interesting because I think you should hear more of it, because I think they are. I think are specific groups like If Not Now making
if
that
not
point.
Now, I would certainly say that. I mean, they're a little controversial. They're certainly more, you know, there's Jewish Voice for Peace, If Not Now. Those
JVP,
are the two.
I think, is a little more
right.
radical, a little less careful in what it says than If Not Now.
Yeah, so exactly. So, but both of those groups are definitely, I think, afraid of this. You see this coming out from places like, you know, from stalwarts on the Jewish left, like Jewish Currents. I've seen arguments more along these lines. I mean, it's an important one to keep in mind, because if you've got, maybe we can move on to the regional picture here in a second instead of focusing here in the U.S. But if you've got, sort of leaders of the Israeli state arguing that they represent Judaism in its entirety, then you're forcing that conflation.
Yeah, it's as I think it was somebody said, the two groups that conflate Zionism and Judaism are anti-Semites and kind of far right pro-Israel people who you know demand certain kinds of allegiance from Jews broadly, as if it's, you know, and so on. It's sad, and it's very worrisome, not the only worrisome thing in the world, but it's this week's,
but why don't we go ahead over to what's actually happening in the Middle East then? So the big story coming out of the region has been generally that you're seeing a lot more pressure from European states. You're seeing even pressure from the Trump administration, at least sort of suggested pressure for Israel to kind of end its, I don't even know what to call it, its significant expansion of its campaign in Gaza, which, you know, Barak Ravid of Axios wrote that the goal of this is entirely the flattening of Gaza and essentially the destruction of all buildings there. And so we're seeing a really significant escalation of the war. We're seeing a blockade that is now starting to slowly be broken down, but there's still not a significant amount of aid that has actually reached people. So I don't know. It's interesting. Do you think that we're reaching a moment where there could be a more significant break between Israel and a lot of its Western backers?
Well, I think there's always been more obvious potential for that with like Europe. And right. And you are seeing, you know, David Lammy was saying unprecedentedly critical things this week, the foreign minister of Britain, about Israel. You know, but I mean, what kind of surprises me about Netanyahu's persistence, and look, he wouldn't be the first politician to put his own political fortunes, his own political short-term survival ahead of the interests of his nation. But, you know, historically, I think one reason Israel has been able to not care that much what the world broadly thinks about it is that there was the United States, most powerful country in the world, gives it cover at the UN, sends it weapons, you know. But if you look at the polls just in America, any leader of Israel should be very concerned. Most Republicans, was it Republicans or conservatives that break down in that poll, professed conservatives? Either way, it was most of them.
Are you talking about the poll I just brought up?
Yeah, yeah. The was it under 40 or under 50 on the right had an unfavorable view of Israel. And most Democrats and most Americans had an unfavorable view of Israel. Just put that way. Is your view favorable or unfavorable? And this is new. Wasn't this way 3, 4, 5 years ago? I guess all things are possible. I would say there that the, you know, the pro-Israel lobby kind of groups and donors, you know, constitute collectively a pretty powerful force. So it's not going to be, it'll be a long fight if there's some kind of fundamental shift in American policy toward Israel.
Right. Yeah, I guess it's interesting. It's more of a short-term thing, right? Because Trump, of all people, seems less, he seems easily bought, perhaps, kind of maybe listens to the last guy he talks to, but he doesn't seem like someone who's particularly afraid of any individual interest group in the way he goes about his policy. So you would think that if anyone would do it, that he might be able to do it. But again, it would require significant sort of patience and steadiness that you don't necessarily tend to see from him.
If you're hoping that Trump will you know, fundamentally change the U.S. Relationship with Israel, like really lay down law, say, hey, we're cutting off the weapons until you end the war, something like that, I think your hope lies in Trump's history as a businessman of just like, once the project he's paying for is actually completed, he just refuses to make the last payment. He was notorious for that. He's just like, he's that transactional. And if he does consider himself a second term president, you know, notwithstanding all the things that by his own account he has done for Israel at the behest of Miriam Adelson, of the Adelson donors, then there might be a change. He might just say, hey, it's been nice, Miriam, but I'm not going to run for election again. Who knows?
Yeah. Well, anyway, it's very interesting. There's a lot going on in the Middle East, so we'll obviously be following those stories more. There's a little bit, I mean, the Iran talks, I don't know if there's so many updates, but they have continued, which is itself some sort of good sign, right? They held another, I believe it's the fifth round of talks in Rome this time, this morning, and have been sort of making some progress. So maybe there is some hope for a bit more stability in the Middle East, at least in the near term here. I guess we'll have to follow that. I'm not sure. Did you see any significant? I haven't seen any significant news coming out of this latest round of talks.
No, you wonder if Trump has the sheer competence to pull something this complicated off. You know, he is showing some instincts I approve of in some ways, certainly taking the sanctions off of Syria. And you know, in these talks, it's a little unclear whether he's asking for too much. You get signals both ways. But I just worry about the competence issue.
Right. Yeah, well, why don't we go to, this is one that's been very interesting to me and that has some very non-zero-y kind of themes in it, which is Trump's Golden Dome announcement this week. So we mentioned in the Earthling this week and in some previous editions that the sort of Space Force has been getting a little bit more involved in offensive or sort of just active military things. But now we're seeing that The Golden Dome missile defense system that Trump has promised to build would, for the first time, put American weapons actually in space, right? Would put interceptors that we would consider defensive, but that our opponents might not, in space, that would be able to fire down at, you know, let's say a hypersonic missile coming towards the United States. I mean, it really could be. I think this is one that's going under the radar in terms of its arms race implications. I think that a lot of people are kind of laughing at it. They're talking about the price. They're talking about maybe it will or won't be effective. And those are real questions. But I think that the potential of this to increase tensions, especially between the U.S., China, Russia, get more weapons in space and lead to things that are going to be pretty unpredictable. I think the potential of that is quite high.
Yeah, you're right about the defense offense thing. And part of the problem is defensive weapons tend to inherently have offensive potential. If we really could build a shield that we considered leak-proof, we would then have the ability to launch like nuclear strikes and stuff and not worry terribly. And they know that. Or just get belligerent at a lower level and have some confidence about our ability to survive the retaliation. Now, here's a test that I'm guessing somebody your age can't pass. Do you know, does the term strategic defense initiative ring a bell?
I can pass this one. That's Star Wars.
That is Star Wars. Very good. There's a reason that you're in charge of Non-Zero World, Connor.
That's right. That's right.
That's the Reagan. I mean, I remember well. I wrote about it. It was pretty widely mocked. It was the same idea. It was a space-based missile defense system.
Right.
When it was less practical than now. Now, some people. I mean, first of all, that was a time when if something was pretty widely mocked at the elite level, that really was bad news for it. Now it's different. Like Trump's, the more elites, you know, shower disdain on him, the better for him politically. So it doesn't matter if people like us mock it. But some people say that Star Wars was a masterstroke because, I have to say, I'm so self-conscious. The term elites, when I apply it to myself or you, as I just did, I want to emphasize, it's a sociological designation. It just, like, journalists are considered elites in this, you know, I'm not saying we have high status. I wish.
I don't know. you're too modest, Bob. I think you probably have higher status than I do, unfortunately, but we're trying to change that. That's why I have this cool background and stuff. We're thinking it could really lead to the elite flip.
Yeah. No, I'm hoping that your rise will proceed faster than mine did. There are people who look back and say, but Star Wars was a masterstroke because it brought the Soviet Union to the table. Suddenly they wanted to, you know, nuclear arms talks and everything. They were terrified. It's one of the things that won the Cold War for us. Well, that's pretty conjectural, but I would say, look, there's no comparison to the Soviet Union then and China now. I went to the Soviet Union in the early 90s, shortly before it ceased to be the Soviet Union, went in the fanciest department store in all of St. Petersburg, went to the electronics section, and at the counter, you know, behind the glass, in the counter were a bunch of vacuum tubes that people used. They would buy them and go home and repair their TV sets. Well, TV sets hadn't had vacuum tubes in the U.S. in years and years. And there were like washboards for sale, like as opposed to washing. I mean, it was, we didn't understand during the Cold War itself, most of us, how far behind us the Soviet Union was technically. China is a totally different ballgame. Okay. I do not recommend getting into a race with China on this. It'll be at best super expensive for both, almost certainly destabilizing, more likely to lead to war. It's just so sad to me that we humankind is at this point where it is so obviously in the interest of each nation to put relations on a different level and recognize how many non-zero-sum games we are facing together. It just is what an indictment. It's just sad that we're even talking about this.
Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting too, because I guess, I don't know if Trump is even thinking about those implications of potential arms race with China or anything, but it is a really big step. And also, I mean, to your point, right, China has these sort of extraordinary industrial capacities, these technical sort of advances that have been really moving quickly in recent years. And perhaps more importantly than all of that is just this concept. So I mentioned kind of that broad concept of like offensive and defensive weapons being sort of construed, you know, a defensive weapon is construed by your enemy as an offensive weapon. But There's another thing going on here, which is just that like the entirety of nuclear deterrence, like we've said, relies on the ability of one side to be able to guarantee that it will have a second strike capability against the other, right? So that the U.S. is completely capable without doubt of destroying China, even if China destroys it. And that is what the entire logic of, I mean, this is mutually assured destruction. This is what we've talked about for 50 years now. And whenever you do these advances in missile defenses, really ironically, and it's a thing that people don't kind of get, but it really can be destabilizing. Every time a gap grows between offensive capabilities of one side and defensive capabilities of the other, every time China might become convinced that we can shoot down its nuclear weapons before they hit us in a second strike situation, then they will become more convinced that they need a hell of a lot more nuclear weapons, and a hell of a lot more nuclear weapons potentially being deployed in different places, right? Like this could be step one. You know, slippery slope arguments have some, you know, problems, obviously, but this could be step one on the way to having nuclear weapons in space or to having serious missiles being out there. And then from there, you know, there's possibility of disastrous destruction of satellites, of all kinds of issues that we're only really vaguely able to understand.
Yeah. And just to show you how far humankind has fallen in terms of wisdom, the basic point you made that the key to nuclear deterrence is the confidence that you would survive a first strike and could unleash a retaliation the other side would find unacceptable. Okay. The fact that is the source of stability in a world with nuclear weapons used to be not only recognized by both sides on the Cold War, but enshrined in something that was called, I get nostalgic when I say it, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, which George W. Bush abandoned. The Soviet Union and the U.S. agreed in the 70s. Why waste money on these defensive systems when they are only destabilizing, and they agreed not to build them? George W. Bush tore that up, by the way, shortly after Putin begged him not to, which in turn was shortly after Putin had been the first leader to call Bush after 9/11, had helped him in the Afghanistan war, and Bush said, thanks, but screw you. We're getting out of this treaty. It was one of a number of things that, from Putin's point of view, were very disrespectful of him and Russia, and helped, I think, ultimately lead to the Ukraine war. But it's just pathetic. You know, this is like 50 years ago. We were already, the planet was to the point where it was officially enshrined in a momentous international agreement that we wouldn't do stupid shit like Trump is doing with this Golden Dome thing. Right. And here we are.
Right. And it just, I mean, the era of arms control really does feel, if not over, very, you know, very drastically changed. I mean, it is interesting to contrast the Russian and Chinese responses here a little bit too, because I think part of the big problem, or I would say with a pretty high confidence that a big part of the problem, is that China still does not view it as necessary to engage in significant arms control talks with the U.S. And they didn't put that in their response to this, whereas Russia was abundantly clear. They said that this underlines the need to conduct talks about strategic stability, which is a euphemism for, you know, nuclear weapons. And the sort of difference between those two, the fact that, you know, the U.S. and Russia remain in broad parity in terms of nuclear weapons, in terms of these broader issues, and China remains a little bit smaller and unwilling, you know, in terms of its number of nuclear weapons and unwilling to enter into these talks. We've just got this sort of unstable period in which there is so little desire to actually get anything done.
Yeah. It's sad. And I mean, I don't want to get on my hobby horse here, Connor, but with like AI, the AI revolution starting to pick up momentum in a way that I think is getting more and more people's attention. I'm seeing more and more writing about this, more and more recognition of it. It's a terrible time to not be in a fundamentally cooperative frame of mind with other, especially powerful nations, especially AI superpowers like China.
Right. Right. Now, well, we should talk about AI. Maybe we'll save the AI talk for overtime. There are a few interesting items that we had in the Earthling this week about. So Anthropic has this fancy new model that has some sort of security consequences that could be related to it. There are news lines related to AI doctors as well. But is there anything else we want to talk about on this side of the paywall before we move there?
I think we should say that in June, we're going to take June off so far as the newsletter is concerned. We will, the podcasts will still keep coming, and including the overtime segments and so on. And we will also be, for paid subscribers, we'll be adding a month onto your account, like a free month onto your account. So that'll push back whatever your expiration date is. But I feel a need to retool in light of a lot of changes in the media landscape, some involving AI. More changes are afoot than I think people may realize who aren't in media. And you know, there are other reasons that maybe I'll get into in some other venue, but yeah, so we'll be back right after the 4th of July as far as the newsletter goes, but the podcast will keep coming. And, you know, the newsletter at nonzero.org is still the place where you will find each podcast. I mean, in addition to YouTube and your podcast feed, but I mean, if you want to go and sign up, become a paid subscriber just so you can see the overtime segments, that will still be the place to go.
Yeah.
Anything I should have added?
No, I think that covers it. Well, like we said, you'll get a free month, all people who are paid subscribers and or NZN members, as we should mm-hmm. say, much classier. You know, that reminds me, I used to work at Target, and they call you like
you
a team member there. I worked
wait,
at Target.
Wait. What did you
day.
Do at Target? Were you a checkout
I
person?
I was on the floor. I like, you know, shelves, stocked the shelves and did stuff like that.
Did you answer questions from customers?
I answered a lot of questions from customers. I answered a lot. They assumed that I was an expert on all things Target contained. That was not true. I was 17. Someone would come up. A woman once came up and asked me like what bug spray she should get because she was afraid of getting Zika. I guess that gives you the time frame. She was afraid of getting Zika on a trip to Brazil. And I was like, I don't know what bug spray you get, but this one says it's good. For I don't know, it's got a lot of DEET apparently. So that was kind of my answer to her. But I was like, I don't know if I'm the right guy to be asking this.
Yeah, just give him an answer with great confidence.
Oh, that's actually really where I learned giving answers with great confidence. That was my training for the podcast.
That was your training for journalism was to talk about shit you don't know as if you knew.
That's exactly right.
So anyway, there will be, in addition to this newsletter, there will be a newsletter next Friday, which is the final Friday of the month. And then we'll be back after the 4th of July and we'll be podcasting the new month.
But anyway, yeah. So we'll, on the other side of the paywall here, we'll talk a little bit about, those AI updates I mentioned. I want to talk about, I had a piece, in the newsletter this week about the sort of Putin's parrots. Yeah. Trope. I think it's a very interesting one to dig into. And also there were a lot of interesting responses in the comments that might even be worth bringing up a little bit. I responded to one or two in text form, but maybe talking about them here would be helpful as well. But is there anything else people should be aware of before we head to?
No, they should definitely check out that piece. My wife liked that, by the way.
Oh, well, thank you. That's very
And it wasn't just a parrot. It is a great picture of a parrot, but Clark gave us. But no, it is an important piece. It's a big problem with it's not totally unrelated to what we started out talking about how you are allowed, how you're supposed to talk about tragedies. And if you emphasize the war in Gaza, are those Hamas talking points? Somebody could say that, right? And it's like, I don't know. They may be. I can't control what other people's talking points are. But you were looking at it in the context of Ukraine and arguing that this attitude is actually impeding progress toward peace in Ukraine.
Right, exactly. Well, so why don't we go ahead? I'll make that argument in a little bit more length and we can discuss it more on the other side. But thank you to everyone who stuck around so far, and extra thank you to everyone who will continue.
This was a free preview of Non-Zero World. To unlock the rest of this conversation and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at nonzero.org.